Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of January. All things political, you always hear this Mondays at 1 o'clock. We'll start with Governor Chris Christie. Did he appear to be an honest man during that two-hour news conference? Can he survive the investigations into Bridgegate? And now, facing federal investigation into whether he used Hurricane Sandy relief money to produce tourism ads starring Christie and his family. The jobs picture is not very bright. The government said Friday that employers added jobs at the slowest pace in 3 years in the month of December, which brings to mind the long-term unemployed. Al-Qaeda banners were raised over the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi. And what are the prospects for the Affordable Care Act this year? Our guest this hour happens to be a health care expert, so we'll spend some time on that issue. And then there are other issues in the news as well. Our guest this hour is Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, served as a healthcare policy advisor to Mitt Romney. He was just named opinion editor at Forbes. He's the principal author of The Apothecary, the Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. He is at the Manhattan Institute doing research on the Affordable Care Act, universal coverage, entitlement reform, international health systems, and FDA policy. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll start with Chris Christie, although I was reading before we went on the air a Pew Research study that shows that this issue is not a very big one with the American public, so but I would imagine that you, being politically minded, will have thoughts about what's going on there. So feel free to call us. The earlier you'd like to call, the better, and you'll be first in line. So off we go. Ovik Roy, thank you very much for being with us. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, Kathleen. How's the weather out there in Wisconsin?
You won't believe it, because I hate to say it, it's very momentary. Tomorrow it's going to be cold. Right now it's 43 degrees. I know. I can't believe
it. That's balmy.
I know. I just can't believe it after last week. It's a roller coaster.
Sure is.
And how about you? How's the weather there?
It's 48 here in New York, but same thing. We had 10 degrees on Monday of last week and bitterly cold. And I was in Michigan for the holidays, and pretty similar weather to what you guys had to deal with.
Yeah, it was just awful. That 18 below is hard to take. Well, yeah. Spring is going to be here eventually. Let's start with Governor Chris Christie. And he's facing now federal investigation, we've learned today, into whether he used Hurricane Sandy relief money to produce tourism ads starring Chris Christie and his family. What did you think of that incredibly long news conference? Did he come across as an honest man, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you would have a two-hour press conference where you answer every single question to really everyone's exhaustion if you felt that you had anything to hide. I think the one thing that the Governor Christie could have done better is he could have done more to talk about the consequences of the traffic jam, to speak more about the people who were stuck in that traffic jam, the people who couldn't get to school, et cetera.
Yeah.
He spent a lot more time talking about how he felt betrayed by his aides, which he has every right to feel. But I think that was the one thing, if he looks back at the tape, he probably would have wanted to do differently.
So what does he need to do to redeem himself here and to keep his chances for 2016 very much alive?
Well, I think that aspect of everything has been a bit overblown, in the sense that, as we all know, political memories are very, very short, and 2016 is a long time away, particularly considering that he has to get through a Republican primary before he wins a general election. And really, what's going to matter in the this is not going to have any impact on the Republican primary, unless it turns out to be a much bigger scandal than it appears right now. What it appears right now is that a couple of his aides went haywire and did some things they shouldn't have done, and as soon as Christie found out about it, he axed them. If that's not true, if there's something more to it, then obviously it could affect his chance.
Mm-hmm. Do Republicans have mixed feelings when it comes to Chris Christie?
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing about Christie, obviously he's an incredibly talented politician,
yes,
very
he
relatable
is.
You know, I hear from so many of my Democratic friends how authentic he strikes them and how intrigued they are by him as a candidate. So I think his political talent is real, and natural politicians, particularly in presidential elections, tend to be the ones who win. And he's that combative personality, which people comment on a lot, that tends to be an asset in the sense that on the right, you know, people are looking for someone who's going to fight for them. It's the same reason why Howard Dean was so popular on the left. People like that pugilistic side of a politician. Where Christie is meets some skepticism on the right is that from a policy standpoint, he's more moderate. You know, he's combative, but if you actually go down the line and look at his policies, he, for example, expanded Medicaid, something that a lot of Republican governors haven't done. That's one example of many of areas where he might diverge from where the Republican primary voter would want him to vote.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to job growth. The job numbers released last Friday, and they're not very good, showing, I think, probably the most important was average monthly job growth for the year of 2013 was 182,000, basically unchanged from the year 2012. We're just not creating very many jobs.
Yeah, it's a problem, and I think more importantly than the fact that we're not creating any jobs, I mean, that is a big problem, but even more alarming is the number of people who've given up on seeking work altogether. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because the baby boomers are retiring, but part of that is people who just seem so discouraged by the tough job market that they've stopped seeking work, and that's a real problem because obviously just the human toll of that is very important, and the economic toll of it is as well.
So what do we do about that? How do we create jobs? We've been asking this question for a long time.
Well, there are two major issues that have plagued the job market, I think, since the Great Recession started. The first is that we've seen a proliferation of regulations that affect the way businesses run. And those complying with those new regulations cost money, and that's resources that companies are spending complying with regulations rather than on hiring people. And similarly, taxes have gone up and have a potential to go up further, something that also affects the ability of businesses to hire people. And there are some other factors, too. For example, the minimum wage, which polls well and has been the subject of a lot of activity at the state level, a lot of state referenda around raising the minimum wage. But if you increase the cost of hiring somebody, that means that there's just less of those jobs that you can hire, that you have the resources to hire people for. So what we need to do, I think, is rethink how we support the low-wage, entry-level labor economy by making it easier for employers to hire people. And if the jobs don't pay as much as we might like them to, supplement that with means-tested welfare programs or anti-poverty programs rather than making it harder for employers to actually hire people.
And what do you mean by means-tested welfare programs? What is that?
Well, there are, of course, a plethora of them today. We spend in 2012, we spent $916 billion on means-tested anti-poverty programs. So that's things like cash welfare, supplemental nutrition assistance, Medicaid, housing assistance. There's a whole range of these programs, some at the federal level, some at the state level, that at the end of the day are designed to help lower-income people get by. And a lot of those programs aren't efficiently designed, and so a lot of the money that we allocate for the purposes of helping lower-income people doesn't really get to them. And again, we have this other problem, which is that people who want to find work, it's very hard to find work because there just aren't a lot of jobs out there. And that's not to say there isn't the money. So, you know, we've had this Federal Reserve policy, this monetary policy led by Ben Bernanke and soon to be Janet Yellen, of pumping a lot of money into the economy with the hopes that that will stimulate job growth. It hasn't done that. What's happened is basically the banks have gotten rich off of the Federal Reserve's policy, and people who have a lot of investment in the stock market, in housing, in real estate, in bonds, those people are making a lot of money. So the distressing aspect of the economy we've had over the last five or six years, it's been great if you're a bank, if you're an investor, if you have a lot of wealth already. It has been great for the people who are unemployed and are looking for a job.
Mm-hmm. The president evidently is going to call for an increase to, what, $10.10 of the minimum wage during his State of the Union address later this month. Is there any chance that that will happen? And from what you've just said, I would assume that you would not be in favor of that.
I think there's a chance it could happen because it polls well. And so obviously a Congress, whatever its ideological view of the issue or philosophical view or economic view of the issue, is responsive to public sentiment on that. But I wouldn't expect it to have any impact on the actual employment picture. And let's not forget that the minimum wage laws aren't really that well targeted. So if you're the teenager who's the son of two wealthy parents in a well-off suburb, you benefit from a minimum wage expansion as much as, if not more so, than somebody who's poor, who's struggling to find work, entry-level work. So, I'd rather say let's expand something like the earned income tax credit, do something that's actually targeted towards low-income people, rather than A, making it harder for companies to hire people or costlier for companies to hire people, and B, something that isn't actually well targeted to the people who need the help.
Let's move to Obamacare. You've written extensively on this and studied it extensively. You recently wrote a column, Obamacare Exchange Enrollment More Adverse Than Previously Expected. What is that?
Yeah, so Humana, which is one of the large insurers that participates in the exchanges, put forth a filing, published a filing that it's submitted to the Securities Exchange Commission called an 8K form. And what an 8K form is it's a filing that publicly traded companies that have their stock listed on the stock exchange, the stock market. Humana had to publish this 8K, and they're required by law to publish an 8K form every time that there's a material event that might substantially affect the price of the stock. So usually what happens is there's some unexpected news that either plus or minus will affect the financial prospects of the company, then they have to file these 8K forms. So in this case, Humana filed an 8K form saying that based on recent developments, they felt that their participation in the exchange was going to be one that they were going to have some financial losses from, because a much sicker and older pool of enrollees was signing up for the exchanges than they had anticipated. And they cited specifically some of the last-minute changes that the administration has installed in the last several weeks. You know, so there were these famous different patches, you know, with the whole like your plan, keep your plan thing, and mm-hmm. then the president saying that, well, you can keep your canceled plans, and there were some other adjustments like that, the end result of which meant that healthier and younger people had more of an incentive to stay out of the exchanges because they'd get lower premiums that way.
So as you look toward this year, is this a make-or-break year for the whole program, would you say?
I don't think so, actually. I know there's been a lot of talk of that nature on both the left and the right, you know, the left in dread and the right in sort of glee. I'm sort of a more moderate view on that. I actually don't think it's going to be a make-or-break year. I think what's going to develop is what I thought would happen all along, which is that the entire structure of these exchanges is designed to provide a good deal for insurance for two groups of people: really poor people who are going to get subsidized premiums, and that's the first group. The second group is sicker people. So if you have a chronic disease, you have a serious medical condition, and you either couldn't get insurance before or your insurance was really expensive before, you're going to get a much better deal under Obamacare. But everyone else, the vast majority of people who are actually pretty healthy and have average incomes or above, those people are going to pay more for insurance under this system, and it's not going to be that attractive to them. So those people aren't going to have as much incentive to sign up, especially when the individual mandate hasn't really come into full force. So I think in year one, year two, we're going to see the trends that seem predictable all along. The real make-or-break year is more year three, year four. If there aren't enough people enrolled in the exchanges by the time we get to 2017, and let's say there's a Republican administration in 2017, then the law could be more vulnerable to repeal if not enough people have signed up. So they've got a couple of years.
Have you seen any recent numbers? How many people are signed up now?
Yeah, so the HHS is releasing tonight some new enrollment numbers on that, which I have obtained, but they're embargoed, so I'm not able to discuss them with you right now. But
okay.
Stay tuned for a discussion of that later today.
Okay. And finally, from me, before we go to our phone calls, for those who fought there and were injured there and loved ones who had people who lost their lives, this raising of the Al-Qaeda banners over the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi seems to me to be a fairly large news story. We fought the battles there, and to see that flag go up in those cities really raises some profound questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's really sad. I mean, this is one of the things that that has been true of American fighting for a long time, which is that we go in there, we fight the fight, we make some gains that are hard won and very costly, but we lose our stomach for the fight and pull out. And all the treasure and blood that we spent achieving those gains gets frittered away. And I don't have an easy answer to that, because I sympathize with those who feel like, you know, why are we there and what's our objective and all that. I understand all that, but it is tough to watch, and it's tough to see those gains fritter away. And I don't know what the solution is, because it's the changes that have been made to our stance there are, and our position there are pretty irreversible at this point.
Ovik Roy, our guest for All Things Political, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls pretty darn soon. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've talked about the troubles that are before New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. What do you think? Has he answered honestly? Has the press made too much of this story, considering that he has been talked about so much as a possible Republican presidential candidate in just a few short years? It's understandable how much attention has been devoted to this story, but what do you make of it? We are speaking with Ovik Roy, who is really an expert on healthcare as well. He does extensive research and knows quite a bit about the Affordable Care Act, universal coverage, entitlement reform, international health systems. So feel free to give your predictions of what the future is this year and beyond for the Affordable Care Act. Unemployment down a little bit, but the job growth numbers are really pretty dismal that were released last Friday. What do we do to make the economy stronger and to get people jobs? Fairly important. And if you'd like to comment on the Al-Qaeda banners being raised over the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi, we're going to do an assessment. It's been a long time since we've talked about the strength of Al-Qaeda, and we're planning on doing that tomorrow at 1 o'clock, but I'm interested in your thoughts on that as well. So to you, momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ovik Roy is our guest now, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, served as a healthcare policy advisor to Mitt Romney, just named opinion editor at Forbes. And our phone number, our lines are busy now, just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. Dave in Cobb is our first caller. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon to you both. I'm wondering, the thing with Governor Christie in New York State, Jersey. I was wondering, things seem like things are happening. First is this traffic thing, and now this thing about Sandy.
Right.
I was wondering if he's going to survive, you know, the things going to keep happening to him, and put him out of the race. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. There are a lot of people investigating him now, I assume, Ovik, don't you think?
Yeah, well, the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, has opened an investigation, and of course, the state legislature, which is democratically controlled, is also conduct its own investigation. So there are going to be investigations. There was a trove of emails that were released over the weekend. The initial take on those is that there wasn't a lot of new information in them, and that has led a lot of people to conclude that this probably will. This probably won't explode into some larger scandal, but you can never know with these things. And I think what's clear is that the investigations will continue. I think what's more interesting actually than that aspect of it, because we just don't know, we can't speculate on what will be found later. What's interesting is to think about is how this will affect Christie politically in terms of his administration in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It's already had an effect on in terms of top aides being forced out of the administration. How will it affect his ability to govern in New Jersey? I mean, I don't think anyone is particularly shocked that in New Jersey, let alone in other states, that politicians will negotiate and sometimes play hardball with each other to gain endorsements and support and things like that. Obviously, this was way over the line, this particular incident. But will Christie be hamstrung in his ability to actually negotiate with Democrats on a lot of issues that he had held the upper hand on in his first term? I think that's going to be interesting because he worked with Democrats in that legislature and got a lot of his agenda through, despite the fact that you'd think that they would be trying to oppose him at every step.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe in his second term he's not able to be as effective as a result. But I think he's still going to run. And I think that I don't think this is going to have much of an effect on the Republican primary 3 years from now.
When is he? Did I hear during the news that he's giving the State of the State address in New Jersey tomorrow, is it, or today? Do you know?
That could be. I hadn't heard that, but that wouldn't surprise me. This is the season for such expressions. And, I would expect that he will probably touch on this. But again, given that he's already spoken exhaustively about it, I wouldn't expect any new news in the State of the State address on this topic. I think what's going to be interesting is, again, what's his policy agenda? That's going to be what will be most interesting, because like many governors who want to run for president, he's not only looking to govern New Jersey and do a good job there, but obviously he's perhaps hoping to appeal to a broader audience with what he's doing in New Jersey. And I think that's going to be interesting to keep an eye out for, is what's the issue set and what are the policy problems that he's going to focus on in his second term, and what are the ramifications of that for how he might fare in a Republican primary.
Tom in Black River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi, ma'am. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It puzzles me that the president, when we passed the stimulus package back in his first term there, that was supposed to take care of the economy. And here we are 5 years later, we're still going back and forth in Congress about unemployment benefits. Why don't they just come out and admit that anything that he has done has not worked? It's causing more income inequality than anything that I know of in my lifetime. And also with the budget, or with the deficit. He promised he'd cut that in half. And now the budget is completely out of control. Unless some people in the media hold this guy accountable, we're going to continue to do this for the next 3 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because obviously Mitt Romney, when he ran in 2012, the strategy that he adopted was that if the unemployment rate is above 7.4%, the challenger always wins, and so I should be able to do pretty well. And it didn't work out that way. And I think a big part of the reason why it didn't work out that way is that voters, not unfairly, said that a lot of the problems that the president was facing, he inherited. I don't think that that's going to be that isn't going to fly in 2012 or 2016, excuse me. So I think if we're still seeing this kind of relatively stagnant, slow recovery, where there's still a lot of unemployment, still a lot of people who've been discouraged from seeking work, and the deficit and the debt problems continue to accumulate, I would expect that by 2016, the right Republican challenger should be in a position to say, you can't blame George W. Bush for the last 8 years. But whether it'll end up that way or whether things will finally turn around, we have yet to see.
Let's take on this issue of income inequality, because a lot has been written about this very issue and that it's at its greatest level. We haven't seen anything like this since the 1920s. Would you agree with Tom's assessment that it is President Obama's fault that we have such income inequality? Is it important, do you think, to address this issue in this country? And if so, how?
Yeah, I would look at it like this. I don't think it's a big deal if rich people are rich. I think the big deal is, do people who are on the bottom end of the ladder, do those people have the opportunity to rise up? And I think America has historically been a place where we've celebrated great entrepreneurs. We've celebrated the Steve Jobses and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Bill Gateses, and we haven't begrudged them for their success, because we've related to them. We said, we can, someday if I work hard, I can be the next Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. And the trouble in America is that to the degree that people don't feel that that is true any longer, that the deck is stacked against them and they don't have the ability to rise up. And that problem of ensuring that there's economic and social mobility among people at the lower end of the income ladder is a very complex problem. Some of it you can address through policy measures, and a lot of it you can't. But a big part of it is our education system. I think we need to do a lot to improve the way we educate kids, particularly in lower income areas. We need to do a lot to ensure that public policy doesn't make it more difficult for people to start companies and get hired and find, you know, join these small businesses that are just trying to make it. I think that's very important. And I think one thing that's actually very tough for public policy to address, but we have to try to think about it, is the relationship of family breakdown to poverty. There's a very, very high correlation. The two biggest things that correlate to poverty are A, whether you've been raised by your biological parents or not, and second, B, whether you have a job. If you have a job, whatever the job is, high wage, low wage, whatever, 97% of people who are employed are above the poverty level. So the people who are unemployed in America typically tend to be people who are unemployed, or people who are in poverty tend to be unemployed, and it's often correlated to things like having poor educational opportunity and not being able to be raised in a home where you had, you know, two parents looking out for you. And that's a difficult and touchy subject, and people get really hot-blooded about it. But I think we need to be sober, and we need to think hard about the relationship between family breakdown and income inequality.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What about the other issue, though, that when you look at what the average worker is making, he or she is just having a hard time getting ahead, that it's a whole different world than it was in, let's say, 1964, which we talk about next hour of the show, when everything was booming and people were making good wages and women, rightly or wrongly, stayed at home, actually. So it was a whole different scene. We're also looking at the salaries of those who are very wealthy among us being something like 270 times what the average worker is, which is huge. Is that okay for our society, or do we need to address a way for the middle class to feel like they're making some progress?
Yeah, so again, a lot of points, jumping off points to your question, Kathleen. So the first thing I would say is that one thing that's really important when we talk about income inequality, we tend to talk a lot about income inequality and not a lot about cost inequality. That is to say, it doesn't just matter what your paycheck is, it matters how expensive the basic supplies and needs you have are. So, for example, how much are you paying in rent? How much are you paying for food? How much are you paying for gas? How much are you paying for heating and air conditioning? Those things matter just as much, if not more so, than how much you're actually making in salary. Because if you're living in a place, a part of the country, or at a time point, a time frame in which the cost of living is low, then you can get by with a lower wage. Where you face incredible pressures to make more money is if the cost of living has gone up. And that's something that public policy not only tends not to address, but we in the media don't tend to talk about it. We don't tend to talk about the importance of cost of living as an issue in income inequality. That's to say, there are some areas where we've made a lot of progress. So food in general is cheaper in America today than it was in 1964. Clothing is much cheaper today in 1964. Obviously, things like cell phones and smartphones didn't even exist. So there are a lot of things about living life today. Healthcare is another example. There are basic things like heart pills and blood pressure pills that didn't exist 50 years ago exist today. So that's why people are living longer than they did before. So there's a lot of areas where there's progress. But where there's challenges, we definitely need to do what we can to think about it. On your point about how the wealthy are getting wealthier, I would say this. One thing that's really important to think about here is that we live in a global economy. So a guy like Mark Zuckerberg 50 years ago, the equivalent entrepreneur, he would have made it big, and his market would have been America. Now, if you're Mark Zuckerberg or the equivalent entrepreneur, your market is the world. So one of the reasons why the most successful entrepreneurs are getting wealthier is because there's a global market for their goods and services in a way that there used to only be a domestic market. And another related point to that is that so much of the economy now is based on technology and information and the internet and software and things like that, whereas the economy of the 60s, where everyone did well, was driven a lot by manufacturing, industrial jobs, right? Today, those jobs aren't here. And I think one of the persistent elements of inequality that we're going to have to address in the future is what to do with the particularly overwhelmingly male unskilled workforce that was used to doing manufacturing and industrial labor, those jobs are shrinking or going overseas, and they're not coming back. And Charles Murray is a guy who's written a lot about this. He wrote a book recently called Coming Apart, where he talks about the divergence, and to make it sort of economically empirical, he talks only about whites in America, and he said there's basically this divergence between the college-educated whites who are doing extremely well in this service-based, information-based economy, and lower income whites who are more part of the industrial economy, which is going away.
Let's go. Thanks, Tom, for your call. Chuck in Lake Delton. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. See, with all due respect to the men and women that went to Iraq, there's a black granite monument in Washington D.C. with 58,000 names on it, where we lost the whole deal, and if we don't study history, we're bound to repeat it. Thank you.
I think that's absolutely true, and these questions are tough. I think it's very important that we honor the people who made those sacrifices in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think one thing I'll take issue with some people in our political debate is I think the mission was honorable. I think it was an honorable mission to try to bring democracy and liberty to those countries, because I think at the end of the day, so long as there are dictators in that part of the world, it's going to be a dangerous part of the world. And I think if we can find a way to encourage democracy and people who want to choose their own government truly and freely, then it's going to be a safer part of the world. Because history shows that, if you might talk about the lessons of history are that people who have the opportunity to choose their own governments tend not to want to fight wars. And so that's something that I hope we can eventually find a way to achieve in that part of the world, but the United States' role in that is something that I think is legitimately open for debate. Is it really our responsibility to make sure that the rest of the world improves on these scales? And maybe it has been over the 20th century, but I think it's eminently fair and reasonable to ask whether that should still be our role in the future.
Mm. Well, that brings us to former Defense Secretary Gates, whose memoir was published, and it's been getting a lot of press, his comments that the president, Obama, doubted his own policy after he decided to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. And Gates says he was skeptical, if not outright convinced, that it would fail. Do you think that you can sense the what he says is true by the way that the president has conducted U.S. policy in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I don't think, it's obviously getting a lot of play in Washington, the Gates book, but I would say that these revelations aren't that surprising. I mean, when Senator Obama was campaigning to be president, he made a big display of saying that while he always opposed the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war was a just war, mm-hmm. and it was worthy of our attention and worthy of our involvement, and cynics said, well, he's only saying that so that people don't think he's a peacenik, because when in fact, if you actually look at Senator Obama's history and his philosophy, there was much more reason to believe that yes, in fact, he was just uncomfortable with war in general, and this was more of a political posture. And when he first came out with that semi surge in Afghanistan, that a lot of people in the military said at the time, the recommendations that the generals made were not the recommendation that the president or the directive that the president actually went forward with. There was a lot of concern that we'd have the outcome that we have. So I don't think it's surprising. I think it just confirms what seemed to be the case based on the information we had at the time.
Karen in Independence, hi.
Hi. Boy, when you started, or when I got put on hold here, there was just a simple question or point I wanted to make about the HHS for the Affordable Care Act. And as I'm listening to you to speak, I have so many more questions. But my original question was, the other day I heard there was a two-page bill, and I don't know if it's out of the House yet, but it was actually just that the HHS needed to notify anybody that signed up on their website that if it got hacked into, they would let them know that their identity was stolen. And what I had heard was the repercussions from that was that HHS stated that, this hasn't happened, so why would we need to do that? And as I'm listening more here, I think that something that people don't hear about or the media doesn't cover, because we no longer have as many media outlets in the United States, I think there's only four now that give us our news, is nobody's talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which right now Obama has on the fast track. I believe Congress had just gotten here within the last couple of weeks or months what it is. And only five of those, there's 29, I believe, I think you would call them laws that are within this TPP. Five of them deal with trade. And the other 24 deal with corporations and how corporations would become sovereign under this act. And then when you have, as I was listening farther down, I'm thinking, well, the way we would have to start to work at some of this stuff is corporate America is America. We are a corporation. And I think that one of the first steps is to stop the TPP and then get Citizens United repealed.
All right. Thank you, Karen. You brought up a host of issues. You want to start with Trans-Pacific Partnership? Ovid?
Yeah, so let's start with that. I mean, I personally support free trade, and one of the reasons I do is because of this issue that we were talking about before, which is the importance to income inequality of cost of living. One of the things that massively drives prosperity and true income equality in America, or let's just call it economic equality in America, is the fact that things are so much less expensive today, except for health care and gasoline. Most things are much cheaper. Clothing is a good example of that. And one of the reasons why clothing is so much less expensive today than it was 50 years ago is because a lot of clothing is manufactured overseas in low-cost areas where they can manufacture these goods less costly. So, yes, that means we don't have as many garment manufacturers in America. Those jobs have gone away. But it also means that 300 million Americans can buy clothes at a much less expensive price than they could before. And so I think that's something that we can't forget when we talk about the issue of free trade, is that we often focus on the jobs we lose to other countries as a result of free trade, and we forget about, A, the fact that it means that often we actually pay a lot less for goods and services that are really essential to us, and also that we're helping the prosperity of these other countries, and to the degree that we care that the rest of the world is prosperous too and not just America, it's not such a terrible thing that we engage in more economic activity abroad.
Now, are you concerned about some privacy issues when it comes to the Affordable Care Act?
I am, and, you know, in fact, Congressman Dianne Black, who sponsored the bill that the caller was mentioning, we ran an op-ed by her at my blog at Forbes just a couple of days ago on this very topic. It is a big concern, and it's a big concern based on the reports that have come out from the government itself. So the Obama administration itself, career officials in the Obama administration, to be sure, have been writing these reports basically explaining that a lot of the privacy safeguards that you would normally expect of any new major federal IT project were not installed or have not yet been secured in the Affordable Care Act's exchanges. And that's a big problem. And some of the people who really are knowledgeable about this stuff have said that these are some of the biggest violations of the Federal Privacy Act in the history of that law. It's about a 40-year-old law that safeguards or governs the safeguarding of citizens' information, private information by the government. So these are big issues, and I think what's happened here is that the administration was so focused on getting the websites and the exchanges up and running on October 1st because they were so fearful that a slower launch would be politically embarrassing, a delayed launch might make the law more vulnerable to repeal in the future. They were so concerned about those political questions that they put the actual functioning of the site into the second tier of their concerns. And I think that's what's resulted in the problems we've had. And it is a big concern. I know people today, friends of mine, who are uninsured and have refused to go on the Obamacare websites in their states because they're afraid of identity theft.
Really?
And until that gets fixed, they don't want to sign up because they're afraid their personal information is going to get stolen.
Hmm. Ovik Roy, our guest this hour for All Things Political, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He was a healthcare policy advisor to Mitt Romney, and he was just named, as of January 1st, opinion editor at Forbes. He is the principal author of the much-respected blog Apothecary, the Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. Our phone number, a couple lines are open now. They've been very crowded, but now you could get through. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And you are always so welcome to leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Coming up on Central Time today, Veronica Rickard and Rob Ferret talk with a guest who says early prison release programs are bad for communities. They'll talk about the top news of the day. That's from 3 until 6 this afternoon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for our guest and to Barbara in Green Bay. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling because I questioned some of the comments made by your guest, and perhaps I misunderstood. But I believe he mentioned that we have to get the deficit under control, and it is my understanding that the deficit is going down. And then I was very upset with his comment about 1964's clothing prices and saying that we have to be happy that the third world countries, well, he didn't use that term, however, that's mainly where they're being manufactured, provide them for us at a cheaper rate. What that really indicates is an arrogance about, and I hate to put that word in to play here, about what we as consumers can have at the expense of others, and I think of Bangladesh particularly. And then my last comment was about Iraq being a noble cause because it stood for democracy being foisted onto the people of Iraq. That is not why Iraq was fought. Comments.
Right. Thank you, Barbara. I'm sure Ovik will have some. Ovik.
Well, I'll just disagree with you about Iraq. I think that was the stated goal from the beginning. On the point about clothing manufactured in third world countries, again, I would just disagree. I think, yes, should the conditions whereby Bangladeshis work be more adequate than they were in that particular incident that the call is referring to? Absolutely. But is the alternative to say no? We shouldn't want people in India and Bangladesh and Vietnam to be employed. We shouldn't want to buy their products. We should let them, you know, starve or work in the fields or do nothing. I mean, it seems to me that there's quite a bit of merit in saying it's a good thing for us to buy their goods. And if people want to buy goods made in America, they're of course free to do so. They might have to pay more for those goods, and we see a lot of that, right? So, for example, if you buy your coffee at Starbucks, you're going to pay more for it. But what Starbucks warrants as a result is that we make sure that the beans are from fair trade growers and things like that. And some people want that. But some people actually just want to buy clothes or coffee at a lower price. And that's not such a terrible thing.
Thank you, Barbara, very much for your call. Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Scott.
I haven't talked to you since the big event. First I'd like to ask your guest about the folks who are, I guess I have a speculation that the folks who are afraid of going on to the website for fear of identity theft, I sure hope they weren't shopping at Target.
Yeah, absolutely.
but I have a minor clarification of something that I think I heard former Secretary Gates interviewed this morning on Morning Edition, and he was at pains in that conversation to say that in his book he did not accuse the president of being cynical in asking for the surge. He said that what he actually wrote in the book is that at the time of the surge, the president was convinced it was going to work. But over the course of it, he became disillusioned and of course, very disappointed in Karzai's behavior. So, you know, and I know it's not a big thing possibly, but it's just I think he that's what he really intended in his conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way I would put it very simply is that I think the president sincerely is a deep skeptic of war and of military intervention generally by the United States, and he's also a deep skeptic of the view that America should really take this leadership, you know, kind of almost jingoistic or leadership role in the world. His view is that America should have very fairly humble and collegial relations with other countries, even if that means an abnegation or a neglect of its own global interests. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate philosophy of foreign policy that's been around for a long time. And obviously there are going to be people who disagree with that, and that's what politics is for, for people to debate and vote for the people they feel most represent their views. But I don't begrudge the president his view, and I think he's been fairly forthright in expressing it.
See, I'm not sure he has been forthright. I think the American public has difficulty understanding exactly what the policy has been in Afghanistan, because he hasn't been real forceful about, you know, saying why all the troops were sent there. Obviously, what's been going on has been troublesome, I think, to the administration, certainly to the American public. So people are saying in huge numbers, get the heck out of there. And maybe it's a fault of his leadership on this, or who knows what all it is. But it seems to have kind of been a quagmire.
I think one thing that tends to be true, it's not true of every Democratic president, but Democratic presidents, I think the progressive movement generally tends to be very focused on domestic policy, whereas the conservative movement tends to be more of a mix. There tends to be the kind of foreign policy hawkish types, as well as the libertarians, plus a lot of domestic. So there's just a on that particular topic area, there's like a whole foreign policy establishment that tends to really come in when there's a Republican president and take those issues I don't want to say a seriousness, because I'm not trying to say the president's been unserious, but I do think there's just a degree to which it just hasn't been a focus for him. His focus has been on domestic affairs, and I think there's a degree to which he sees foreign policy, other than getting out of Iraq and fulfilling his campaign promises, it's somewhat of a secondary issue to him, and I think that the relative inattention or lack of priority to some degree affects a lot of these decisions more than it should.
On the other hand, he did get bin Laden, and I know that Gates said that was a very brave decision he made.
Yeah, certainly, and as I said, I mean, I'm not trying to throw him under the bus and say that he's been in any way incompetent on these issues. I think it's more that he doesn't have I don't want to say stomach, but I think to prosecute any goal in politics at the presidential level requires enormous determination and prioritization. And I don't think it's been the number one priority of his administration, or even the number five priority of his administration, to have some clear objective as to what we should do in Afghanistan and what should we should leave Afghanistan with. And so when you don't have that fairly clear determination and strategy and the will to pursue it, then you're going to get to a muddle. And I think that's true with almost anything that presidents get involved in, and that's certainly true in something as complex as the situation in Afghanistan.
Yeah, point well taken. Just briefly, Travis in Mount Horeb, almost out of time. Travis.
Yeah, I just have a quick couple of comments about Obamacare. I'm self-employed. I have a lot of friends that want to start their own business, and Obamacare has made that option a reality for people that want to jump in. Don't have to worry about their family not having affordable health benefits. My benefits, what I pay now, have gone down extremely. And one final thing is, every small business signs up their employees online, whether it's through Unity or Physicians Plus. So this fear of being online, you're already online if you've been enrolled by an employer. I mean, that's the reality.
All right. Thanks, Travis, very much. Oh, Vic, I'd like to say, I hope you'll come back and let's do a full hour on healthcare sometime. I would love to do that. And I want to thank you so much for joining us this hour. You're a fabulous guest. Thanks.
Oh, you're very kind, and stay warm out there.
Yeah, you too. We will today. It's tomorrow we're worried about. Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, served as a healthcare policy advisor to Mitt Romney. He is just named opinion editor at Forbes magazine. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. as well for on-air production here in our studios in the very balmy downtown Milwaukee, 44 degrees. For a little while. Thanks for your calls, everybody. Stay tuned. 1964 is up next.